and did some pretty painful things to people. You didn't. You had a reputation for justice and never for cruelty, except for that thing with your wife, maybe. Fire reflected very brightly in his dark eyes. How I stole Persephone, you mean?
Did you? I asked.
And regretted it almost immediately. For a second, I wanted very badly to know a spell that would let me melt through the floor in a quivering puddle of please don't kill me. Hades stared at me for a long, intense period of silence, and then breathed out something that might have been an extremely refined snort from his nose, and sipped more wine. She came of her own will. Her mother failed to cope. Empty nest syndrome. I leaned forward, fascinated despite myself.
Seriously? And the pomegranate seeds thing?
Something of a political fiction, Hades said. Hecate's idea, and my brother ran with it. As a compromise, no one came away from it happy.
That's supposedly the mark of a good compromise, I said.
Hades grimaced and said, it was necessary at the time.
The stories don't record it quite that way, I said. I seem to recall Hecate leading Demeter in search of Persephone.
That comment won a flash of white, white teeth. That much is certainly true. Hecate led Demeter around, and around, and around. It was her wedding present to us. I blinked slowly at that notion. A honeymoon free of your mother-in-law. Worth more than gold or jewels, Hades said. But, as I said, I've never been the most social of my family. I never asked the muses to inspire tales of me, or visited my worshippers with revelations of the truth, what few I had, anyway. Honestly, I rarely saw the point of mortals worshipping me. They were going to come to my realm sooner or later, regardless of what they did. Did they think it would win them leniency in judging their shades? He shook his head. That isn't how I operate. I regarded him seriously for a moment, frowning, thinking.
You didn't answer my question.
Words are not my strong suit, he said. Did you ask the best question? I sat back in the chair, swirling the wine a little.
Hades had known we were coming, and we'd gotten in anyway. He'd known who I was. And there was, quite obviously, some kind of connection between Hades and the Queens of Faerie. I sipped at the wine. Add all that together, and I nearly choked on the mouthful as I swallowed. That won a brief but genuine smile from my host.
Ah, he said. Dawn.
You let Nicodemus find out about this place, I said.
And?
Mab. This is Mab's play, isn't it?
Why would she do such a thing? Hades asked me, mock reproof in his voice.
Weapons, I said. The war with the outsiders. Mab wants more weapons.
Why just get revenge when she can throw in a shopping trip at the same time? Hades sipped wine, his eyes glittering. I stared at him, suddenly feeling horrified.
Wait. Are you telling me that I'm supposed to take those things out of here?
A much better question, Hades noted. My armory exists to contain weapons of terrible power during times when they are not needed. I collect them and keep them to prevent their power from being abused in quieter times.
But why lock them away where anyone with enough resources can get them? I asked.
To prevent anyone without the skill or the commitment to use them well from having them, he said. It is not my task to keep them from all of mortal kind, only from the incompetents.
Then I got it, and understanding made the bottom of my stomach drop out. This hasn't been a heist at all, I said. This whole mess, it was an audition? Another good question, but not the most relevant one. I pursed my lips and tried to cudgel my brain into working. It seemed too simple, but hell, why not take the direct route? What is the most relevant question, then? Hades settled back into his chair. Why would I, Hades, take such a personal interest in you, Harry Dresden? Hell's bells. I was pretty sure I didn't like the way that sounded at all. Okay, I said. Why would you? He reached out a hand to the middle head of the dog and scratched it beneath the chin. One of the beast's rear legs began to thump rapidly against the floor. It sounded like something you'd hear coming from inside a machine shop. Do you know my dog's name? Cerberus, I said promptly. But everyone knows that. Do you know what it means? I opened my mouth and closed it again. I shook my head. It is from an ancient word, Cerberos. It means spotted. I blinked. You're a genuine Greek god. You're the lord of the underworld, and you named your dog Spot?
Who's a good dog?
Hades said, scratching the third head behind the ears and making the beast's mouth drop open in a doggy grin.
Spot is. Yes, he is.
I couldn't help it. I laughed. Hades' eyebrows went up. He didn't quite smile, but he nonetheless managed to look pleased.
A rare enough sound in my kingdom, he nodded. I am a guardian of an underground realm filled with terrible power, the warden of a nation prison of shades. I am charged with protecting it, maintaining it, and seeing to it that it is used properly. I am misunderstood by most, feared by most, hated by many. I do my duty as I think best, regardless of anyone's opinion but my own, and though my peers have neglected their charges or focused upon inconsequential trivialities in the face of larger problems, it does not change that duty, even when it causes me great pain.
And I have a very large and very good dog.
Spot's tail thumped the side of Hades' chair like some enormous padded baseball bat.
Whom other people sometimes consider fearsome.
He turned to me, put his wine glass down, and regarded me frankly.
I believe, he said, that we have a great many things in common.
He rose and stood before me. Then he extended his right arm.
You are here because I wanted to take a moment to shake your hand and wish you luck.
I stood up, feeling a little off balance, and offered my hand. His handshake was... You can't shake hands with a mountain. You can't shake hands with an earthquake. You can't shake hands with the awful silence and absolute darkness at the bottom of the sea. But if you could, it might come close to what it was like to trade grips with the Lord of the Underworld and to receive his blessing. Wish me luck, I breathed, when I could breathe properly again. You aren't going to help?
It is not my place, Hades said. I wish you good fortune, and will hope that you triumph. But even if we yet lived in the age where my will could guide the course of destiny, it is not for the Lord of Death to take sides in this struggle. The fate of the weapons you have found must be decided by those who found them.
But you've already helped me, I said, just by pointing out what was going on. Hades didn't smile, but the corner of his eyes wrinkled.
All I did was ask you a few questions. Are you ready?
I have one more question, I said.
Mortals generally do.
What will happen to Deirdre?
Hades drew in his breath. His face became expressionless. For a long moment, I thought he wasn't going to answer, but then he said, Relatively few new shades come into my realm these days.
Foremost among them are those who perish in the gates, particularly at the Gate of Blood. She will remain in my keeping.
The things she's done, I said quietly. The people she's hurt. And she gets to skate justice?
My host's eyes became hard, flat, like pieces of coal.
This is my realm, he said, and there was a note in his voice like the grinding of tectonic plates.
Behind him, Spot let out a warning growl, magnified by three throats and rumbling in that huge chest. It sounded like machinery in a slaughterhouse. I didn't answer. At least I had enough brains to pull my foot out of my mouth and stop talking. I bowed my head, as meekly as I knew how. Hades' voice smoothed out again, and at a gesture of his hand, Spot quieted down.
Should you survive the hour, consider your classics again, Sir Harry, and revisit the question in your thoughts. I nodded and thought of others in the underworld. Tantalus, Sisyphus, vultures tearing out livers, water that could be carried only in sieves, and ever-spinning wheels of fire, punishments tailored specifically to the soul in question. I didn't know what was going to happen to Deirdre, but she wasn't going to get off light.
I understand, I said quietly.
Hades nodded.
You will return to the same moment in which I slowed time, he said. And in the same position. Are you prepared?
I drew a slow, deep breath.
I guess I'd better be.
His eyes flickered and he gave me a brief nod, maybe of approval. Then black fire swallowed me again.
Chapter 42.
If there's any kind of device built into this thing, I can't see it,
Valmont reported in a near whisper and rose from behind the altar. I looked around a bit wildly, my eyes taking a second or three to adjust to the dimmer light. I was, just as Hades had said, right back where I'd been a few objective fractions of a second before. 5 artifacts. Mab had promised Nicodemus that I would help him recover the Grail. She hadn't said a damn thing about any of the others. So that meant that there were 4 things I could keep away from him right here, right now. Nick hadn't seen them yet, so he couldn't know for certain that they were here. I had to recover them if I could, but keep them away from him at all costs. That meant getting them out of sight and splitting them up as best I could. But it meant more than that. It meant winning the game Mab had set up for me. Or, now that I thought about it, the game Mab had rigged for me. Mab had arranged to give me a target I couldn't miss if I tried. It wasn't a very appetizing target, but not every job I'd done was clean and enjoyable. I knew how to win the game to Mab's satisfaction. The trick was going to be both winning the game and surviving it. Mentally, I went over those cards that I'd been holding close to my chest. Yeah, if I played them properly, I thought I had a winning hand.
Right, I said quietly.
I stepped up to the altar and started seizing holy objects, the placard, the crown.
Take these, I said in a whisper, passing them to Valmont. Get out of sight. Stow them in your pack if you can. Hide them somewhere else if you can't.
Valmont stared at me with her eyes wide.
Why? They can't be allowed to fall into the wrong hands, I said.
Dresden, she said. I'm in this for the money, and revenge if I get a chance at it. I'm not here for a cause.
I clenched my jaw for a second and then regarded her frankly.
Anna, I said, when have I ever done wrong by you? I need your help. Who do you trust more to get you out of here, Nicodemus or me?
She stared at me hard for only a fraction of a second before she gave me a curt nod and took them. She started stuffing them into her pack. She hadn't filled even half of it with diamonds and was able to slide them in.
Hey, is that the shroud?
This one looks older and shabbier than the one you stole from the church, I said, rolling up the old cloth and stuffing it into my duster's pocket.
It was thin stuff, terribly thin, and made a smaller bundle than you'd think. Hell, maybe that investigative panel was right. Maybe the church does have a knockoff.
But I thought that one had power, she asked.
It did, but not like this. My fingers still tingled from touching the cloth.
Besides, we're talking about the power of faith here, I said. Enough people believe that the fake is really the shroud. Maybe that's enough to make it powerful all by itself.
Seems like a cheat.
Don't knock it, I said.
Her head snapped up and her eyes widened.
Tristan,
Anna hissed. I heard footsteps approaching a couple of seconds later. My heart thudded in my chest. I managed to get the knife and slip it up the sleeve of my duster, then quietly slid the cup into the exact center of the altar. Even that brief contact was like touching a live wire. Tingles flew up my arm and set every hair of my body on end. I fought to suppress a full-body shudder, and about half a second later, Nicodemus appeared, trailing Michael, Hannah Asher, and the Janosqua. Asher carried my staff in one hand, the lights of its runes gradually growing dimmer. She looked tired but smug, wearing one backpack that sagged with wealth, and lugging a second like a too-heavy carry-on bag at the airport. There, Michael said when he spotted me. He looked relieved, and he hadn't, as far as I could tell, picked up anything. Thank God. I waved a hand at the group, using the gesture to let the knife fall a little deeper into my sleeve. Over here. Found it. They all came down to the stage with me. Nicodemus's eyes were narrow with suspicion as he walked.
Dresden? You found the grail?
I just had Valmont check this altar for traps, and she says it's clear, I said, not quite lying. I just got done examining it myself.
Why did you leave your staff back there?
Nicodemus asked, his rough voice harsh.
A distraction.
Figured you guys could use it as a waypoint to find us, I lied blatantly. I stepped aside with a little Vanna White gesture, revealing the cup, and said,
Ta-da!
Nicodemus stared hard at me for a second, then at the cup on the marble altar. I could see the wheels spinning in his head as he thought. Michael's eyes went to it as well, widening.
That's it? Michael asked. That's really it?
Thing makes my teeth buzz, it's so powerful, I said. Yeah, I think that's it. I looked at Nicodemus and said, You've got your damn cup, let's pack up, get Gray's share, and get the hell out of here. Nicodemus walked a slow circle around the altar, examining it. His shadow twisted and writhed with eagerness where it fell on the floor around him. I took a step to one side to avoid letting it fall on me, because... ick. I know you've been aching to have your hands on my staff, I said to Asher, as Nicodemus examined the altar for himself. I held out my hand.
But I'd rather be the one fondling my tool. Wizards are weird like that.
Wow, she said and flashed me a grin, her face flushed, excited.
You left me nowhere to go with that one. I have nothing to add. I'm just that good, I said.
She tossed the staff back to me, imprecisely, and I fumbled it for a second and nearly dropped it. I had a hell of a time both catching it in my right hand and keeping my left arm bent enough to keep the knife from slipping out of my sleeve. And the brass hilt of the knife clicked against the aluminum splint still on my left arm. Nicodemus looked up sharply at the sound. His eyes stayed on me, dark and opaque, for a moment.
Miss Valmont, he said quietly, go back to the entrance. Stand watch there and tell Gray he's free to collect his share.
Valmont hesitated, looking at me. She was a liability here. If I could get her clear, it would be harder for Nicodemus to use her against me. Also, the more I could spread these artifacts out, the better. I nodded, and Valmont vanished silently toward the entrance to the vault. Michael came to stand next to me and abruptly tilted his head, looking up at the statues.
Harry, he asked, does that statue look like Molly to you?
Oh, crap. I so didn't need this kind of thing distracting either of us right now. I said, what? No, that's absurd. Maybe a little. Some people might think so. She's got, one of those faces. He pursed his lips and eyed me.
Would you get your head in the game? I said. Trapped in the underworld? Possible epic Greek menace all around us? Focus, please.
Michael eyed me.
Damn it, I so didn't need this right now.
Anna had by now gotten well out of the way. For the next few moments, Gray might be distracted with collecting his share, leaving Nick and the Janosqua against me and Michael. I'd take that fight. But where would Hannah Asher come down? Whichever side she chose would have the advantage, and that was that. Asher liked me on the one hand, but on the other, Nicodemus had saved her life against the Salamander, and she'd signed on to be part of his crew, not mine. If she held the Binder's mercenary code, she'd back Nick's play and not mine. I racked my brains for anything I could do to get her to come down on my side at this point, but I had nothing. Man, maybe I shouldn't have rejected her advances, especially not if she'd already been feeling the rejection from Binder. Maybe that would have made a serious difference. On the other hand, who knows? It had been a while for me. Maybe that would have hurt my chances even more. Something nagged at the back of my brain, an instinct that was attached to Asher but too vague to make any sense out of. The moment was passing when Nicodemus was at the height of his tension and uncertainty. If I didn't hurry, I was going to lose it. Time to start pushing. "Would you hurry it up?" I said to Nicodemus. "I don't want to get eaten by a three-headed dog or maybe bump into the shade of Medusa because you went into gloat mode like every evil overlord shouldn't. I told you we already checked it." "If you don't mind," Nicodemus said, going back to his examination, "I'm going to make certain for myself." "Oh, for Pete's sake, you can't be serious," I said. "Mab is a tricksy bitch, but she's good to her word. She gave you her word that I would help you secure the cup and bring it back as long as you didn't get up to any shenanigans, and that's what I'm going to do. It's safe. Stick a needle in my eye." Nicodemus continued in his slow circle. "You get all cautious now?" I asked him, and I shifted my staff into the crook of my left arm and plucked up the grail. Nicodemus's hand went to his sword and his eyes narrowed, but I just held it speculatively, bouncing it in my hand. "See? No traps. It's not an Indiana Jones movie, man." Nicodemus remained there, frozen, but his shadow exploded back across the amphitheater stage and climbed halfway up the rear arch of the seating, its edges flaring out wildly like a monstrous cobra. As tells go, that seemed like a pretty damn big one. My stomach turned as I began to speak, but I didn't let that show in my voice. "This is what you came for, right?" I said quietly. "What your daughter died to give you? Hey, if I dropped it, do you think it would break?"
"Dresden," Nicodemus said.
There was no silk in his voice now, only rasp. "Gravity seems a little higher here," I said. "You notice? Maybe exactly high enough to break something like this if it fell. And then she'd have died for nothing."
"Give me the grail," he said, his voice a whisper. "Now."
"Sure, come get it," I said. He started stalking around the altar toward me, and I casually mirrored him, keeping it between us. "Deirdre talked to me about your relationship yesterday," I said. "Did you know that?" He swallowed. His shadow shifted, surging toward me, spreading out in a large circle around us. The light from the upraised hands of the two triple statues grew a little dimmer. It was like suddenly being enfolded in enormous shadowy wings. "She went on about the centuries you two had spent together," I said carelessly. "About how there was no word for how close you two had become because no mortal could possibly understand. Hell, I guess that's true, because you threw her away like she was so much trash. I don't have a word that seems sufficient to cover a father who would do that." At that, Nicodemus went still again.
"Give me the grail," he whispered, "and shut your ignorant mouth."
"You said she was the only one you trusted back where you murdered her," I continued in a conversational tone, putting a little emphasis on the verbs. "Call me crazy, but it seems to me that it's going to be a long, cold, empty place for you for the next few millennia. I mean, talk about having an empty nest. That coin in your pocket must feel pretty heavy right about now." Nicodemus began to breathe faster. He was thousands of years old. He was a villain who had forgotten more victims than the most wildly successful serial killer ever claimed. I had no doubt that he'd killed men for much less reason than I was currently offering him. He was skilled in every form of the infliction of damage and death that the world had to offer. He was the most personally dangerous foe I'd ever faced. But somewhere, deep inside the monster, was something that was still almost human. Something that could feel loss. Something that could feel pain. And because of that, he was furious. And he was beginning to lose control. "This," I thought, "is just about your best plan ever, Harry." "That must have been really difficult for someone so used to wielding power," I said, "to realize that as a result of the life you'd led, there was no one who would willingly come with you, willingly let you slaughter them, willingly pull that lever for you after you had. I'll bet you chewed that problem for years trying to crack it. Did it hurt when you realized what you were going to have to give up?" Nicodemus's chest started heaving and his eyes got wider. In my peripheral vision, I could see Michael standing with his sword at port arms, his eyes cast slightly to one side, focused on nothing. The Janosqua loomed behind him. I saw Michael ripple the fingers of his right hand into a fighting grip on Amarakius and take a slow, centering breath. "The funny part is that bit about her being protected from hell," I said. "You brought her here and expected that she wouldn't get her sentence? Have you read Greek mythology? Do you know the kinds of things Hades sentences people to endure? At least hell is, by all reports, more or less non-discriminatory. Down here, they get personal. Did you just try to give her a comforting lie at the last minute, just to make sure she pulled the lever?" Nicodemus's sword sprang into his hand. "Give me the grail, or I'm going to kill you." Hell's bells. I was hurting him. I considered the grail and felt bad for what I was doing, and I didn't hesitate or slow down for a second. There are weapons that have nothing to do with steel or explosions or vast arcane power, and I used mine. "Do you remember," I asked in a very quiet voice, "the first time you saw her, the first time she looked at you? Do you remember that change, that shift, when the whole universe suddenly tilted? Do you remember looking at her and knowing that you would never, ever be quite the same person? Do you think the cup will do that for you?" I flicked him the grail, sending it in a smooth arc through the air. His eyes widened in surprise, but he caught it adroitly, his whole body shuddering as its power washed over him. I watched him, his face, his posture, and put every ounce of scorn I had into my voice. "I don't know how you said it back in the day, but I'll bet you anything her first word was Dada." Something snapped. His chest stopped heaving. A single tear appeared. And he said in an utterly flat, utterly dead voice, "Kill them." And that ended the game, right there. I win? Chapter 43. With those words, Nicodemus broke his pact with Mab and freed me of any obligation to keep helping him secure the grail. I had fulfilled every ounce of her promise to him, or at least to well within the obligation, as Mab would see it. Hell, I'd actually given him the grail. And if he couldn't take a little harsh truth, as Mab would see it, then that was Nicodemus's problem, not hers. Well, Nicodemus's problem, and mine. The big downside of the plan to infuriate an emotionally traumatized psychopath into trying to kill me was part two, where the lunatic actually did it. As spots for a fight went, this was better than most. It was limited to as few people and as few environmental factors as possible. If I'd waited until we were back in Chicago, Nick would have had a virtually unlimited number of civilians to harm and possibly hostages to seize. Not only that, but I would have had a virtually unlimited number of collaterals to damage, and I didn't imagine that any fight with the head of the Denarians was going to be something I wanted to finesse. Additionally, if we duked it out in Chicago, I would have had to worry about whose side Binder would throw in on, not to mention a possible strike team of Denarian squires standing by in the wings. And on top of all of that, I was pretty sure that Marcone's troubleshooters would be trying to murder us all. Here, in the underworld, I could take the gloves off. The fight would be clean, or as clean as such things got, and I wouldn't have to worry about innocents being harmed. Just, you know, Michael and me. I could think abstract thoughts about the decisions leading up to the fight in the back of my head all I wanted, because the real fight happened almost too fast for any thinking to get involved. The Junasqua lunged toward me, making a foolish mistake. He should have gone after Michael. The Knight of the Cross pivoted on the balls of his feet, and Amorakius blazed into furious light. He didn't move with blinding speed. Michael's attack was all about timing, and his timing was pretty much perfect. As the Junasqua thundered past him, Michael whirled, cloak flying out, and struck a spinning blow that started at the level of his ankles and swept up until he was holding Amorakius over his head in both hands. On the way, the sword cut a line of light into the back of one of the Junasqua's thick, hairy knees. I heard the suddenly parted tendons, thicker than heavy ropes, snap like bowstrings, and the Janosqua's leg melted out from underneath it in the middle of its stride. At the same moment, Nicodemus flung both of his arms forward, and a terrible, smothering darkness came slamming down upon me. I'd had two possible responses to his first attack in mind, and they had to be responses, not assaults of my own. When all this was over, I wanted there to be absolutely no question in Mab's mind that he had turned on me, not the other way around. He might have come at me with his sword. It was how he normally preferred to do business in every case that I had seen. A shield would have held him off, at least for a time. Or, in his rage, he might unleash the full malice of Anduriel upon me, which he had done. This was not a normal circumstance for Nicodemus. I'd prepared the proper defense.
Lumios!
I shouted as the darkness closed in, and I poured my will into the same light spell I'd used earlier, only I added a measure of soul fire into the mix. The light leapt forth in a sphere and exploded into sparks as it collided with something that simply devoured it, swallowing it into nothingness as it streamed forth. The effect was damned odd-looking from the inside. Light poured forth to be enveloped by a slithering blackness all around me, something that recoiled from the sparks and then came surging back in their wake with frenzied agitation. But the darkness could reach no closer than just beyond the reach of my arm. I heard Nicodemus shout something in a language I didn't understand, and the Junasqua let out a howl of furious pain. Something heavy made the ground quiver beneath my feet, and there was an enormous crashing sound. Michael's voice rang out like a silver trumpet calling,
In nomine Dei, lux et veritas!
Steel rang on steel, and I realized that I hadn't figured the numbers right after all. It wasn't Nick and the Junasqua versus me and Michael. It was Nick, the Junasqua, and Anduriel versus me and Michael. And I had the last two as my dance partners. The Junasqua let out a roar, and I knew it was coming right at me. I couldn't move without stepping into that smothering blackness, and that seemed like a horrible idea. So instead, I folded my arms across my chest and muttered, Let's see you ground this, ugly. Then I called upon Winter and cried out,
Octus Spinae!
I expanded my arms out explosively, and as I did, slivers of winter cold froze the water in the air into hundreds of spines of needle-pointed ice that exploded out from me into the darkness and beyond. No magic attached itself to the spines of ice once they had been formed. They simply became sharp, hurtling pieces of solid matter. I was betting that whatever power the Junasqua had to negate the effects of directly applied magic, it still had to follow the laws of magic as I understood them. The bet paid off. The Junasqua let out another ear-shattering roar of pain from no more than 7 or 8 feet away. I used the sound as a point of reference and whirled my staff in a swooping arc, its green-silver soul-fire-infused light driving back the substance of the fallen angel still trying to compress in upon me. My will gathered more winter ice around the end of the staff in an irregular globe the size of my head and harder than stone, and I aimed at the source of the sound and cried,
For Zari!
A lance of pure kinetic energy flung the hailstone from the end of my staff and out through the darkness like a cannonball, and it hit something with an enormous and meaty-sounding thunk of obdurate ice against muscle-dense flesh. I must have gotten him in the breadbasket, because instead of roaring, the Janosqua let out a windy, seething sound. Steel rang on steel again, and I heard work boots pound the marble coming near me. Michael shouted,
"Omnia, vincit Amor!"
And the blinding white fire of Amorakius shattered the darkness around me as if it had been a dry and dusty eggshell. My vision returned. Nicodemus was coming along in Michael's wake, blade in hand, but as Anduril was shattered, he screamed and staggered, falling to one knee, and only managed that because he threw out his left arm to support himself. Not far away, the Janosqua was rising from where he had fallen. The hailstone I'd conjured had apparently knocked him backward over the marble block in the center of the stage, and one side of his ribcage looked distorted. The creature crouched on three limbs, his leg dragging, and bared his teeth at me in a silent snarl, yellowed tusks showing.
"Enough, Nicodemus!"
Michael thundered, and his voice rang from the marble in the riches of the vault.
"Enough!"
The sheer volume and force in his voice staggered me. I found myself standing back to back with him, so that I could keep the Janosqua in sight.
"Has today not been enough for you?"
Michael said, his voice dropping to something almost like a plea.
"In the name of God, man, have your eyes not yet been opened?"
"Michael," I growled low between clenched teeth, "what are you doing?"
"My job," he answered me just as quietly.
"Nicodemus Arcleone," he said, his tone gentle, directed back toward the fallen Denarian. "Look at yourself. Look at your fury. Look at your pain. Look where they have led you, man. Your own child." From where he'd fallen, Nicodemus looked up at Michael, and I saw something I had never seen on his face before. Weariness, strain, uncertainty. "This journey into the darkness of greed and ambition. You stand amongst untold, unimaginable wealth, and you have lost the only thing that really matters because of them, because of the lies and the schemes of the fallen." Nicodemus did not move. Neither did the Janosqua. But I gathered another hailstone cannonball onto the end of my staff, just to be sure I was ready if he did. Michael lowered his sword, the wrathful fire of Amorakius becoming something less fierce, less hot. "It is not too late. Don't you see what has happened here? What has been arranged? All the pieces that have been moved to bring you to the only place where your eyes might be opened, where you might have a chance, perhaps your very last chance, to turn aside from the path you have walked for so long. A path that has caused you, and those close to you, and the world around you, nothing but heartache and misery."
"Is that what you believe this is?"
Nicodemus said in a wooden, uninflected tone.
"My chance at redemption?"
"It isn't a matter of belief," Michael said. "I need look no further than the evidence of my eyes and mind. It's why I took up the sword in the first place. To save you and those like you, who have been used by the fallen. It's why I have been given the grace to take up arms again, this very night, in time to offer you a chance."
"For forgiveness," Nicodemus spat.
"For hope," Michael said. "For a new beginning, for peace." He swallowed and said, "I can't imagine anything happening to my daughter. No father should have to see his child die." Michael's voice stayed steady, quiet, and sincere. "As different as we are, as much separated in time and faith, you are still a human being. You are still my brother. And I am very sorry for your pain. Please, let me help you." Nicodemus shuddered and dropped his eyes. I blinked several times. And for a second, I thought Michael was going to pull it off. And then Nicodemus shook his head and let out a low and quiet laugh. He stood up again, and as he did, his shadow seemed to accrete beneath him, gathering darkness from all around the room and drawing it into a nebulous pool at his feet.
"Quiet, boy," he said, contempt in his tone. "You think you know about commitment, about faith, but yours is as a child's daydream beside mine."
"Don't do this," Michael said, his tone almost pleading. "Please don't let them win."
"Let them win," Nicodemus said. "I do not dance to the fallen's tonight. We may move together, but I play the music. I set the beat. For nearly 2,000 years have I followed my path, through every treacherous bend and twist, through every temptation to turn aside. And after centuries of effort and study and planning and victory, they follow my leadership, not the other way around. Turn aside from my path? I have blazed it through ages of humanity, through centuries of war and plague and madness and havoc and devotion. I am my path, and it is me. There is no turning aside."
The shadow at his feet seemed to darken as he spoke, to throb in time with his voice, and I shuddered at the sight, at the pride in his bearing, the clarity in his eyes, and the absolute, serene certainty in his voice. Lucifer must have looked exactly like that right before things went to hell. I was still standing back to back with Michael, and I felt his shoulders slump in disappointment. But there was nothing of remorse or weakness in his voice as his sword swept back up to guard position.
"Despite all you have given in their service, you stand alone before Amorakius now. I am truly sorry for your soul, brother, but this time you will answer for what you have done."
"Alone," Nicodemus all but purred. "Do you think I am alone?"
He gave us his hungry shark smile, and my stomach went into free fall. Behind the stone block, the Genosqua smiled as well, and that would have been a hideous thing to see if a second set of glowing green eyes hadn't opened above the cavernous gleam of the Genosqua's beady orbs, along with a faintly glowing, swirling sigil in the center of his forehead, and made the sight truly nightmarish. Even as I watched, curling ram's horns erupted from the Genosqua's skull, and the already enormous creature began to swell, growing in mass, his patchy fur thickening, an extra set of limbs swelling out from his sides. Within a heartbeat or three, the shape of a creature like some enormous bear of a forgotten epoch, except for the extra legs, eyes, and the horns, stood where the Genosqua had been. Tons of it.
"Ursiel," I breathed.
A fallen angel so powerful that it had taken all three Knights of the Cross together to take him out the last time he'd appeared. And this time, he wasn't powered by the skinny husk of an insane gold miner, either.
"Oh, crap."
"It gets better," said another voice.
I looked past where Ursiel and the Genosqua stood to find Hannah Asher mounting the steps to the top of the stage. She'd shed her packs, and walking with a lazy, deliberate sensuality, she stretched her arms overhead as she reached the stage, and her clothing just dissolved, like so much smoke, into a clinging, purplish mist that drifted around her in spiraling tendrils, not so much for modesty as for accent, yet for the most part covering her most delicate parts with the same coyness as a fan dancer's feathers. She smiled slowly, and a second set of glowing purple eyes opened above her own as a glowing sigil, vaguely suggestive of an hourglass, appeared on her forehead. I knew the symbol. It had been etched in my flesh for years.
"Lashio," I whispered.
"Hello, lover," said a throaty, playful voice that was not quite Hannah Asher's own. "You have no idea how much I've missed you." I leaned my head back to Michael a little and said,
"You and I definitely need to have a talk with the church about what the word safekeeping means."
Michael glanced at me with a faint frown to let me know that this was not the time. Lashiel laughed, musically, the sound of it pure pleasure on the ears. "Oh, Harry," she said, "did you really think that it's possible to pick up corruption in a nice clean handkerchief and lock it away in a box?" "No, of course not. Forces such as we cannot be contained by mortals, my lover. We are a part of you all." Michael leaned his head back a little toward me and asked, "Lover?" I twitched one shoulder in answer and said, "It's complicated." "Oh, dear." I turned to Lashiel and said, "Hey, Hannah, take it from someone who knows. You really don't want to be doing what you're doing." Asher's human eyes narrowed. "Oh, sure," she said in her own voice, "because the high road is just so awesome. Wardens of the White Council have been trying to kill me for most of my adult life because when I was 17 years old, I defended myself against 3 men who tried to rape me." "I'm not defending them," I said. "But you killed people with magic, Hannah. You broke the first law." "Like you haven't," she snarled. "You hypocrite." "Hey, whoa," I said. "Hold on there. Me and Lashiel have some history, but even if we've been on different sides of the law, you and I don't have a personal quarrel." "The hell we don't," she said. "After a few years on the run, I got in with the Fellowship of St. Giles. You remember them, right? Bunch of folks who fought the Red Court. They gave me training, safe places to live. Hell, I lived on the beach in Belize for 6 years. I had a life, friends. I even fought the good fight." "Yay," I said, trying not to sound as baffled as I felt. "What's that got to do with me?" "Everything!" she screamed, and the purple mist around her was suddenly suffused with sullen, glowing flame. I swallowed, despite myself. "When you destroyed the Red Court, you killed most of the Fellowship with it. All the half-vampires more than a few decades old just withered away in front of our eyes. People who had given me trust, respect, my friends." She shook her head. "And you arrogant son of a bitch! I'll bet you never gave them a thought before you did it, did you?" "If I'd known it was going to happen," I said, "I'd have done it anyway. Because if I hadn't, Maggie wouldn't have survived the night." "The world fell apart after that," Asher spat. "The finances, the coordination, the communication. I was on the street. If Binder hadn't found me..." She shook her head. "Yeah, Binder and his rule number one," I said. "He doesn't know about what you've done, does he?" She narrowed her eyes and her voice became a degree hotter. "Nicodemus and Lashiel and the other Denarians have treated me with respect," she said. "They've talked to me, trusted me, worked with me, made me rich. When one side treats you like a sad freak and a hunted animal, and the other treats you like an equal, it gets really easy to decide where you stand." "Hard to argue with that, but I tried." "Doesn't mean you have to run everything exactly the way he wants you to do it," I said. She let out a harsh laugh. "But I do want to do it," she said. "I've been looking forward to it. Every time you looked at me, flirted with me, spoke with me." "As have I," said Lashiel's voice from the same mouth. "No one's ever turned me down before, Harry. Not once. And to think that I liked you." "We wouldn't have worked out, babe," I said. "Perhaps," she said, "perhaps not. In any case, be assured that I may have one of the few accurate perspectives in the universe when I say that heaven has no rage like love to hatred turned, nor hell a fury like a woman scorned." Ah, so that's what my subconscious had been trying to warn me about. That Lashiel was right there in front of me and itching for payback. "Meaning what?" I asked her. "Meaning that since a whisper in your ear that should have killed you seems to have failed, I intend to skip the subtlety, rip your head apart, and collect our child. She's far too valuable a resource to be allowed to die with you." My eyes widened.
"You
You know about that. Child? Michael said, baffled.
Complicated, I said through clenched teeth.
Well, at least now I knew which side Asher was taking.
I'd tell you to give me the knife, Dresden, Nicodemus said, still smiling. But unlike your friend, I don't do second chances. And you won't have any need for it in a moment.
Ursio made a sound that I normally only associate with tractor-trailer rigs, and which might have been a hungry growl. Then he stepped over the 4-foot block with no particular difficulty and padded in near silence to my left. Lashiel took up station a bit to my right, with Nicodemus making the third point of a lopsided triangle surrounding us. This day was going bad a little more rapidly than I had anticipated. It had, in fact, sprayed gravel on the windshield of my worst-case scenario as it went rocketing past. And then footsteps sounded, and Gray sauntered into the amphitheater, casually carrying Anna Valmont's pack over one shoulder. There was blood on it, and on Gray's fingers.
Ah, Gray, Nicodemus said.
He was enjoying getting a little of his own back after the theater I'd thrown into his face.
And?
Valmont's dead, as ordered, Gray said calmly. He surveyed the scene on the stage as he approached, his eyes lingering on Lashiel appreciatively. We about done here?
A few final details to tie up, Nicodemus said. Have you considered my offer?
The coin thing? Gray asked. He shrugged and glanced at Lashiel again. It's got possibilities. I've got questions. Let's finish the job and talk about them over dinner.
Excellent, Nicodemus said. Would you mind?
I tracked Gray, staring hard at him as he took a position at the fourth corner of the square centered on me and Michael, watching him as he set the pack of diamonds and artifacts to one side and cracked his knuckles, smiling.
I never pretended to be anything but a villain, he said to me, as if baffled by my glare. Should have seen this one coming, wizard.
You really killed her? I asked. No particular reason not to. It was quick.
You are a treacherous son of a bitch, I said.
He rolled his eyes. Maybe you should have been the one to hire me then.
His response made me grind my teeth. There weren't going to be any temptations offered this time, no bargains to think twice about, and no cavalry was about to ride over the horizon. Nicodemus meant to kill us. Michael and I could not win this fight. I heard him take a deep breath and murmur a low, steady prayer. He set his feet and raised his sword to the high guard. I gripped my staff mostly in my right hand, holding it across my body with a few fingers of my damaged left arm, and called forth my will and winter, readying for a hopeless battle. Lashiel turned her hands, palms up, and searing points of violet light appeared in them. Waves of heat shimmered around Hannah Asher's body. Anduriel seethed up around Nicodemus like a dark cloak made from a breaking wave, foaming around the slender man as he raised his sword and started forward. Ursio let out a subsonic rumble that shook my chest, and the Janosqua's beady eyes stared hate from the face of the prehistoric demon bear. Gray tensed and crouched slightly, his bland features relaxed and amused. And I stopped being able to fight back the maniac's grin that had been struggling to get loose as I played my hole card and said, "Game over, man! Game over!"
Chapter 44. A good con doesn't just happen. It's all about setup. Let's rewind. Set the Wayback Machine for 3 mornings ago, just after walking out of that first meeting with Nicodemus and Deirdre at the Hard Rock while riding away in a limo with Mab. I told her who I wanted to see. For a moment, she didn't react. Her eyes were locked somewhere beyond the roof of the limo, her head tracking slowly, as if she could still see Nicodemus and Deirdre in their suite. There was no expression on her face, absolutely none, but the interior of the car had dropped several degrees in temperature, purely from the intensity of whatever she wasn't showing.
"You grow in wisdom, my knight,"
she said a moment later, turning her head back to face the front. Slowly, perhaps, but you grow. He is the logical person to consult in this matter. I have already arranged a meeting.
Oh, I said, and idly fingered the earring, unused to the sensation of something metallic there.
Good. Stop playing with that, Mab said. The less attention you draw to it, the better.
I scowled and futzed with it a little more, just to show her that I could, but she was right. As things stood, it might be seen as a simple fashion statement. If Nicodemus realized that by taking the earring away, he could all but incapacitate me, things could go downhill rapidly once we finally came to grips. So I dropped my hands and schooled myself mentally the rest of the way to the meeting, focusing on accepting the new sensation and dismissing it from my thoughts entirely. I started playing with it again as the limo stopped and Mab sighed. McAnally's Pub is the best of the watering holes in Chicago that serve the supernatural community. It's a basement bar like Cheers, but there the resemblance ends. It's all decorated in stained and polished wood, with clunky electric ceiling fans from the 30s whirling lazily overhead. The ceiling isn't very high, so they whirl away just a few inches over my head, and I remind myself not to do the bunny hop every time I come through the door. Normally, Max does a brisk trade, but today there was a sign on the door that read, "Closed for private party." A second sign hung inside the door, a wooden one, into which the words "accorded neutral territory" had been neatly burned. It meant that the establishment was officially neutral ground under the guidelines of the Unseelie Accords, what amounted to the Geneva Convention of the Supernatural World. Mab had written the Accords, and their signatories defied them at peril of the antipathy of the supernatural establishment, and worse, her personal displeasure. One corner of the sign was scorched and cracked, which had happened in a battle with outsiders who weren't very civic-minded. Mac, bald, lean, and silent, stood behind the bar in his usual crisp white shirt and spotless apron. When Mab entered, he put down the rag he was using to polish the wooden bar and bowed at the waist, somehow giving the gesture an accent of courtesy rather than obeisance.
"Barkeep?" Mab replied, and inclined her head considerably more deeply than she had to Nicodemus a few minutes before. "May your patrons be prosperous and honest." Mac, as a rule, rarely uttered multisyllables. Today, he said, "May your scales always return to balance."
Her mouth quirked at the corner, and she said,
"Flatterer."
He smiled and nodded to me.
"Harry?"
"Mac. I haven't had good food in months, though I'm a little short on funds. I will gladly pay you Tuesday for a sandwich and a beer today."
He nodded. "Thanks."
Mab turned to the table nearest the door and gave me a look. It took me a beat to realize what she wanted and to pull out a chair for her. She sniffed and sat down, folded her hands in her lap, and stared at nothing in particular, dismissing the rest of us from her world as thoroughly as if she had entered a locked room. My contact was waiting for me at a table in the back corner, and I walked over to join him. He was a big man by every definition of the word, tall and strong and solid, with a barrel for a chest and a smaller keg of a belly to go with it. His hair and beard were white and silver, though the rosy smoothness of his cheeks belied any indication of old age, and his eyes were blue and bright. He wore a chainmail shirt and hunting leathers, and a long hooded red coat trimmed in white fur hung from the back of the chair beside him. A simple, worn-looking broadsword hung at his side, and a large, lumpy leather sack sat on the floor beside him, as natural there as a mail carrier with his bag.
"Sir Knight," he said.
"You're here as Kringle, seriously?" I asked him. Kringle winked at me. The Winter Knight called for me in his official capacity as an agent of the Winter Court. Mab has the right to summon Kringle. If she'd called for Vadarung, I'd have told her to get in line.
Donar Vadarung was the name of the CEO of Monarch Securities, a corporate security interest which provided information and highly skilled specialists to those with a great deal of money.
Vatterung had access to more information than anyone I knew, except maybe the senior counsel of the White Council of Wizardry. Only he was a hell of a lot smarter about using it. He was also, I was reasonably certain, Odin. The Odin. Or, if he wasn't, he could do an awfully good impersonation.